Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
Hey there, and welcome back to Candidate Confessional, the show that President Obama, I believe this is a direct quote, he's called it a must listen.
He says that's not true. He actually said it's something that he might have heard about, but not have actually heard.
You're right. I'm looking at it again. He's glanced at it on his iTunes feed.
Hasn't yet quite clicked.
Not quite yet, but, you know, there's still time. So I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Shirkus.
And today, dear listener, we're going to tell you the story of Sandra Fluck. Now, most people know Sandra because of an asshole on the radio.
You're talking about Rush Limbaugh.
Yes. Rush Limbaugh decided to call her a slut after she testified about the importance of insurance companies covering female contraception. And not only that, he mispronounced her name.
What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex? What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right?
And after that episode, she became a personification of the war on women.
Yep.
And to her credit, she didn't back down at all from Limbaugh, even after he went after her and after trolls online threatened her.
Exactly. She made a conscious decision to speak out against the radio host. And, you know, she continued from there. So she became a forceful advocate for women's reproductive rights. She studied for the bar at the same time that she was prepping for her speech at the Democratic Convention in 2012. And then she made the decision that the best use of her time and resources and energy was in the world of politics. And so she decided to run for the state Senate in California.
In some ways, it proved tougher and more complicated than batting down a slut-shaming radio host.
Beyond the bluster.
Behind the bunting.
Past the posters.
After the ads.
The campaign picks up.
And the motorcade moves on.
What happens when the votes are counted?
And democracy doesn't go your way.
This is Candidate Confessional, a HuffPost podcast.
I'm Sam Stein. Okay. I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm Sam Stein.
And I'm Jason Shirkus.
And we approve this podcast. Why don't you tell us how it all began, basically? And that's not just the run for state Senate, but your congressional testimony.
Oh, sure. Well, I was organizing on the campus at Georgetown Law along with a number of other people. That's always lost in these stories, is that there's a whole group of people taking action and coming together. And we were concerned about the lack of comprehensive reproductive health care coverage on our insurance for students. And we tried various strategies to address that. We had done some organizing on campus, collected stories. We'd worked with the administration, negotiated. You know, we were law students, so you know we wanted to sue somebody. So we explored that path, and we ultimately came.
Did you end up suing anybody? Ever?
We did not sue anyone. I would go into all the details, but they would definitely turn off the podcast if I did that.
Enough.
So I will not. I'm not bore the listeners. So we ultimately concluded that the Affordable Care Act and its Women's Preventative Health Care Amendment was the strongest path for remedying the problem we were facing on campus. And so when we saw that being under attack in the very early months of 2012, we decided to speak out. There was a press conference at the National Press Club, and that was seen. And then I was asked to testify
now,
as a result of that.
Why were you asked to testify if there were multiple people involved in this?
I think you want the honest answer.
Sure.
Somebody had class at that time, and no.
Is that really the answer?
Well, that was part of it. That was certainly part of it. I actually skipped immigration law to go and testify.
That's an amazing sort of butterfly effect to that, right?
Yeah, there's certainly those kinds of moments. You know, I think it also had to do with I was in a position of leading the work on campus along with some others, and they figured I was, you know, decent at speaking in public. So there were other things too. But.
So you get invited to this congressional panel. It's famous because there are no men on this panel.
Yes. Yes.
Did you know in the moment that that was a massive mistake on the on behalf of people?
I think America knew in the moment that that was a massive mistake. Okay. So yes, I was aware as well that that was a massive PR mistake on the behalf of Congressman Issa at the time.
And then a couple days go by and nothing really happens of it. And then suddenly...
Yeah, that was weird, right? That there was all there was this time in between, and we kind of thought, okay, this has passed, and then suddenly,
did you just not make anything? Were you like, all right, I did my due in my thing on Congress, and that's that.
It often gets ignored. People
right, don't know that
right.
Does it go viral?
Are you saying C-SPAN 2 isn't the most watched network in America?
Well, we went back to the work, right? I remember I was at a rebellious lawyering conference at Yale the next day and was talking about, you know, you probably saw me speaking to Congress. We want to keep organizing on campuses across the country. You know, we were continuing the advocacy work, but no, we did not expect that there was going to be continued assaults and continued press attention. And then, it was almost a week later.
So where were you when you found out that Rush Limbaugh had called you a slut?
I was at my internship.
Which was?
I was working with the ACLU National Prison Project on some elements of criminal justice reform and addressing things like sexual assault in prisons and things like that.
Well, tell us so you're just like at your desk?
Yeah.
Go on Twitter.
Walk us through
what
it's
like. I was an intern, so I was in my cubicle.
What's it like to find out that? I mean, how do you find it out?
Well, so unfortunately, in the days leading up to that, I was getting an increasing number of very hostile and threatening communications through some social media. Some folks were had found my address. We were really trying to lock these things down, but some things were getting through. And it was increasing, and we weren't sure exactly where it was coming from. And so what happened was that I was sitting at my desk when a friend called and said, I figured out why this is happening.
What does it say about the college co-ed Susan Fluke, who goes before a congressional committee and essentially says that she must be paid to have sex? What does that make her? It makes her a slut, right?
Because I actually don't listen to Rush Limbaugh on a daily basis.
No.
So you strike me
as somebody who tunes in.
I know.
Regularly,
well, there's a story on that, but...
we're here.
Yeah, what's this?
So I grew up
She interned for him.
Prior to the ACLU, Although he did have his time where the ACLU defended him because of his whole issue. So maybe that's
it. Free speech is important.
You're from Central PA, which is very conservative.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. So I grew up in a very conservative rural community. And the guy who I dated in high school, there was just one, just to make the record clear. The guy who I dated for a number of years in high school was a pretty conservative guy. And we originally met because I saw him in the library reading a Rush Limbaugh book and went over and said, "You don't believe anything that's in that, do you?"
Or, wow.
That's my line. Those are my moves, guys.
How do you say no to that? It's
what did he say? He's like, "I'm just... looking, researching the enemy or something?"
No, he was a fan of Mr. Limbaugh.
All right, so let's bring it back in. So you're sitting in your cubicle, and suddenly it becomes apparent to you via various social media outlets that you have been targeted. And you decide to confront it.
Yeah, so I called my parents because I wanted them to hear this from me and not from other folks. So that was the first thing that I did. And then... I talked with some of the other folks on campus who were organizing around this issue, and we thought about what to do with it. And I and we felt very strongly that we could not allow it to in any way appear that this had been successful in silencing me or silencing the other people who were speaking out on this issue. And that was really one of the most important things, was we've got to make sure that what happens here is that they learn that they can't treat women this way and they can't silence us this way.
But that wasn't sort of, as I read, that wasn't a uniformly held position.
There were some that maybe wanted you to stop or be quieter.
Just to let it blow away, basically.
Who did you think thought that?
It was like an advisor or something, professor.
Oh, I don't remember that being a strong thing that was proposed to me. I think there were certainly folks who care about me, who were concerned about me, and who wanted to make sure I took care of myself. And I appreciated very much.
Well, I mean, was there an element, a part of you that was a little bit scared of, because if you've already gotten threats or people had already looked up your address, there was that kind of thing?
Or no? It was something that I took very seriously and addressed and needed to address. And it was certainly an intimidating situation. But for me, the thing that I remember most feeling in those moments was a determination and a conviction about how this had to go.
Real quick, how did you address it? Did you move? Did you, because they knew your address?
I didn't.
Right?
I didn't move. I had some assistance from some folks who had been in law enforcement previously who advised me on some things. And who helped me to scrub the internet of my confidential information. The law school was very supportive in helping. There were an incredible number of things sent to the law school that they had checked. And so there were a lot of folks who were really, really helpful.
We're talking, what, like envelopes that were sketchy that, you know, you didn't want.
There were envelopes, packages. Some folks sent some flowers that weren't in very good shape that in like 2 or 3 weeks when I received them after they'd been checked out. But
sympathy flowers.
Yeah. There was an overwhelming amount of really supportive things that were sent. And then there were some really disgusting, unsupportive things that were sent.
So then you go, it goes like from 0 to 60. You suddenly are everywhere and being asked to do these interviews to talk about the situation. I'd like to gloss over it, but I think we need to address it. I was in the green room when President Obama called you. You were near me, MSNBC. You don't remember me, but you remember Obama for some reason.
That's very, very strange.
Don't quite understand how that happened. But well, anyways, he calls you and you're going on Andrew Mitchell. And
I would just like to apologize because I know that white men are erased continuously in our society.
Thank you.
So I'm sorry.
Finally,
I'm sorry.
Someone gets it.
How long have you been waiting for this?
Basically since you booked her. so I guess what for the listeners, and for me too, because no, this doesn't happen normally. What is it like in the back of your head as you watch you go from a fairly anonymous Georgetown law student to suddenly the topic du jour of the national political conversation?
It was surreal. It was quite challenging because I was trying to be a law student and not fail out at the same time as trying to do all of this. But I felt a weighty responsibility, frankly, is how I felt about that. And maybe that's making it more grandiose than it was or something. But
was there something like out of body about it where you wake up and be like, whoa, I'm like going on a national, you know,
show. It was certainly surreal, but I'm a very get down to business person. So the things I was focused on were, I want to make sure I know my policy points cold. I need to know exactly all the details that I'm advocating for. I need to be prepared.
You're such a liar.
I know. So my whole focus on this, at least as I remember it now, was I wanted to make sure that I knocked this out of the park in terms of the policy. And made sure that we got the Affordable Care Act's birth control policy to be the strongest it possibly could.
When you're in that moment, does the criticism cut through the bubble that you're in? Do you understand how people are perceiving you differently?
Yes. I actually, at the time, I required myself to read all the social media and the emails.
Whoa.
I know.
Bad move.
I know everyone says not to do that, but I did.
Why?
Well, because I believe it's very important to understand your opposition if you're going to address their concerns. And growing up as I did in a very conservative place, I always try to draw upon that and hope to have an understanding that would allow me to reach across and to find ways of communicating. I think, to be serious for a moment, we clearly have a problem in this country. One side talks to their side, and the other side talks to their side, and nobody tries to move across.
And
I shouldn't say no
you're
one.
You're one of these people who thinks that if you just get into a room with your critics, you can find some sort of common understanding?
No. That would be Pollyanna-ish. I think that there are folks who will not agree with you and who will not be convinced, and we need to focus on who we can convince and how we can make progress. But I believe that some rhetoric is damaging and is harmful, and we need to search for the kind of rhetoric that is not.
Did you feel like you had been caricatured enough that people didn't really see who you were, but they saw slut or whatever the conservative media was putting out?
For some people, sure. But I actually found that a lot of people were very open to who I actually was and what I was actually saying.
Did you ever consider the possibility of going on Rush Limbaugh's show?
No.
Why not?
Well, because as I said, I think we need to focus on the areas where we can make progress, and I didn't feel that that would be a way that would actually make progress.
Too much of a circus.
Yeah, I think that not all, but many of his listeners are not people who will be convinced regardless of what I had to say. And I do, and I want to be very clear about this, I think that the things that he said were insulting to every woman in America, and I would never dignify his show with participating in it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So how did the call with the president come about?
So I guess the White House was calling around town. And I just want to point out, this is yet more evidence of my not sluttiness. It's hard to get my number. Okay.
It wasn't like on the bathroom at the
Raven. Right. You've used that line before. That's
no,
too good.
No, I haven't.
She's a politician.
Yeah.
You know what? My husband is actually a comedy writer and comedy producer, and people always ask me if he writes jokes for me, which I find really insulting because I am funny all by myself.
Or at least
I like to think that I'm funny all by
right
myself.
There, yeah.
Anyway, so the White House was calling around to some of the women's organizations around D.C., some of the advocacy groups, trying to get in touch with me, trying to figure out sort of which one was sort of handling me. And, of course, none of them really were handling me because I wasn't actually a plant. And eventually they were able to get in touch with a friend of mine who I was working with. And this was a very challenging time. And as I said, I had immigration law to go to. And she wouldn't give out my cell phone number because she was trying to protect me. And, you know, she said, well, I'll schedule a time. She can call you. And they were saying a senior White House official. They tried and tried and tried, and she wouldn't give it out. And finally, they just said, it's the president.
The White House now tells us that we can reveal that you just got off the phone with President Obama.
Yes, I did.
The stakes have been raised pretty high, but what did he say to you?
This whole thing transpires. At some point, you have to make the decision that you're going to take this moment in your life, and instead of going into necessarily the law, that you're going to go into public service and politics. So how did you make that decision?
It was a long process. I hadn't been someone who was focused politically prior to this. I'd done a lot of advocacy and a lot of policy work, but I wasn't a political person. I wasn't a party person. I wasn't really an electoral politics person. And so this was very new. But quickly after these moments that we've just been talking about with my testimony and things, people started asking me frequently to run for office because, of course, we know that we don't have enough women in office right now. We have ridiculous underrepresentation at the federal level and at the state level and internationally. And so I was being asked repeatedly, and I eventually came to feel that...
Sorry, who was asking you?
Oh, folks who led organizations, members of the public... people, when I would go and give a speech, it would always be one of the questions the audience asked. Folks who believed in the things I believed in and thought I could fight for them. I eventually just came to feel that it was a responsibility that I had, that evidently this was a set of skills that I might be decent at and that I wanted to find whatever way it was that I could most effectively advance the principles and the ideas I believed in, and this seemed like the way to do it.
Was this something you had come to a conclusion on before the DNC, where you gave a speech at the convention, or was it something after the DNC?
Folks were certainly asking me prior to the DNC, but the only thing I had decided on prior to the DNC was passing the bar. I literally spoke at the DNC a few days after I took the bar exam.
Really?
Yeah. So, no, I had not decided to run for office before the DNC. Certainly
so you had,
not.
What, a couple days to work on your speech, or did you work on your speech while you were studying for the bar?
I'm not going to answer that question because it reveals my procrastination and it and the stressful position I put several DNC staffers in, unfortunately.
I'm here because I spoke out. And this November, each of us must speak out.
Well, I'm wondering if there was like a debate that you might have had where it's like, where you had to sort of nervously maybe sort of balance all the attention that you were getting with who you really were. And were you wondering if everyone's asking you to run and you're like, wait, is this really me? Or am I really the policy person before all the hoopla?
Absolutely. I think something that gets lost is that whether or not to run for office is also a career decision. What kind of career do you want to have? And is this the best use of your skills? Or are you better at a different thing? So I went through all of those kinds of thought processes. As many women do, I questioned my qualifications and my preparedness. It's a big problem that women spend too much time questioning that. It was a long, searching process.
You know, because a lot of people we talk to, they always bring up the issue of trust. So they enter a race, and sometimes they're surrounded by people who they've never worked with before.
Yes.
And it's difficult to figure out if those people are in the race for their own benefit, whether it's monetary or fame
That's right.
or whatever, or not. So did you encounter problems of trust with the people around you?
It is a very common experience, and yes, I relate to that experience. The people who I was closest to during the campaign were, for the most part, people I had worked with prior to the campaign.
Yeah.
So I felt lucky to have an incredible team that I did feel that I could trust. But so in many ways, I encountered those trust questions back in 2012.
Yeah, but now you're suddenly this, you know, hot commodity in the political world, and you can see maybe people wanting to sort of ride that into something bigger, right?
Or no.
Or not.
Back in 2012, I worried about that. Okay. I worried less about it in 2014
were there people
when
in 20,
I started the campaign.
Were there people in 2012 that you thought, wait a minute, they seem a little sketchy or...
No, I don't think there was anyone who was involved and then I needed to push them away. I think what I eventually rightfully concluded about the folks who were volunteering their time, is that they cared passionately about what I cared about.
What was the argument that in your mind against running or against becoming a politician versus running?
Good question.
Thanks, Sam.
That was a really good question.
The first time you've said that.
I wondered whether I was the best person or if someone else could do it better. Because I know this sounds like a line. I care about the policy outcomes. I care about the issues.
Oh,
so
come on.
I know, but it's honest.
No, I believe you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I worried about whether or not I was the best person. Yeah. And
do you think men have that worry? Probably not.
Not as much, and I think that's a problem. I think, but I'm not sure that the solution is for women to worry about qualifications less. I think maybe.
Fair enough. I worry that I'm not the best for this podcast.
I think you're doing fine.
Thank
Sam.
You.
That was sad. What else were you worried about?
About whether or not to run for office. It's hard to put yourself backwards
so
about what you thought about that.
What about just intrusion into your private life or?
Check.
Yeah.
Like we'd already been there.
That was already done.
There was no private life left.
You weren't going to get that. So.
And actually, I think that was something that got me over the hurdle that many women specifically, men also, but women really struggle with is the intrusion and the public attacks. And I was like, well, I guess I know how to do that.
So why did you choose initially to... Well, at least consider replacing Henry Waxman. That seemed like aiming high.
So what happened was that it was a total surprise that Representative Waxman was retiring that particular year, and at the same time, the state senator who represented a very similar area announced he was going to run, and so basically the two seats opened up simultaneously.
Okay.
And so I had not been planning and aiming for either of them, and it was just a process of sort of exploring the possibilities. There were a lot of folks reaching out to me about running for the House, but also folks reaching out to me about running for the state Senate. And my decision, which I struggled with, came down to that I thought that I could make more of a policy difference at the state Senate level, and that that's where the issues that I really cared about were more likely to be decided, and that's where I could be impactful.
See, it's funny. I mean, at the surface, most people have been like, okay, well, you've focused your time, at least as far as we know you, on contraception policy that's, you know, federally oriented. Of course, the House would be better suited for you. But that was the public perception.
That was the public perception. Yeah.
So you're saying that that was off.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, rightfully, there's a lot of work that I've done on policy in many years that the public is less aware of than they are of me fighting with Rush Limbaugh, right? So,
So I
worked a lot on human trafficking, on domestic violence, did some gay rights advocacy work, housing affordability, a whole range of issues, and many of the issues that I really care about are at the state level. But this is also unique to California. So if I'd lived in Arkansas, I would probably not have run for the state legislature.
Yeah,
So California, I think, is, and I know, is driving the conversation forward for us nationally. And the work that's happening federally is very important. Much of it is defense right now, in addition to the executive orders of the president. But I felt that in California, we had forward momentum that we are making happen, and that's very important for us to happen.
Yeah.
And that is the better fit and role for me.
Yeah.
And I also think that in California, we're not doing as much on the forward momentum as we should be.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I guess what I just did is sort of a good segue into another question.
You're doing great, Sam.
Thank you. Because I basically, you know, looked at you and saw one issue, right? And I'm assuming that when you got onto the campaign trail, that a lot of voters had the same impulse.
Some certainly, but I am lucky and blessed enough to live in a district of incredibly informed and engaged voters.
Are you running again?
Not at the moment.
Okay.
who asked a lot of questions about a lot of policy issues, and I think that pretty quickly we were able to overcome that stereotype, and they realized that I'm a reasonably substantive person.
How early on did you realize that you had a learning curve, that there was, you're new to being a politician and new to running for office? How quickly did you realize, I have a lot to learn?
Well, I found that it was different areas of the campaign were easier or more challenging, right? Speaking publicly, giving press interviews, I knew how to do that at that point. I was certainly expanding additional areas of policy. Every candidate always is picking up new ones, and I really enjoyed that. I love policy. Fundraising was new for me, and that was something that took some time to get up to speed and get as
loved
fast
it.
As I could.
You're the one person,
the one person
show
who likes begging it. For money.
This is the part of the podcast where people don't like me anymore because I say that I actually don't hate it the way a lot of candidates
wow.
do.
Wow. You're the first.
I know.
What is it about it that you don't hate?
The win.
At least you're honest. Thank
yeah, right. Let me say this. I'm actually, part of my day job is working on campaign finance reform. So I'm very committed to changing the system. But I recognize that in our current system, we have to have resources to fight these battles, and these battles matter to me. And if what is needed is resources, then resources we will have. So I am all about the end goal, and if what I have to do to get there is spend 35 hours a week on the phone, then that's what's going to happen.
That's funny because I misread this, but it seemed like you were powered a lot by grassroots donor base in your state senate race, whereas your opponent was the one getting the max contributions.
No, that's true.
But
I
that's
was
weird
very
because you had this celebrity and you could have possibly gotten these max contributions.
Well, so I think that I was very committed to having a grassroots campaign, but that grassroots campaign doesn't happen on its own. So I was personally out asking for and raising a lot of those small dollar contributions.
Okay.
I also certainly asked for bigger contributions from folks, but I didn't have a natural large dollar donor base that I had already cultivated.
But you had certainly a women's rights, women's health,
absolutely,
national constituency, mm-hmm, that you could have tapped into. Did you consciously decide not to do that?
No, I reached out to, okay, those folks, and they were very supportive. And I want to say thank you to every one of the folks who supported my campaign in whatever amount.
But I think the Democratic establishment was for your opponent, or they endorsed your opponent.
So we had an 8-way primary, also known as a cage match.
is that a technical term?
It is.
Yes.
It is.
Really?
It's
like a caucus, but it's a slightly different.
Wow.
There were 7 Democrats and 1 independent in our primary, and then 2 Democrats moved on to the general, yeah, election. I will not go into it now, but anyone who's listening in a state that doesn't have the top 2, fight it with everything you have. The top 2 is a terrible thing. It increases the amount of money spent in politics. It's bad for progressive policy outcomes. It's a conservative tactic.
Interesting.
So we had an incredibly competitive primary, and I did a lot of work proving myself in the primary. And in the general election, a lot of the grassroots Democrats, the Democratic clubs and establishments were with me in the general election. So I think my opponent and I both had bases of support.
But you still haven't – what did you learn? Early on, what did you learn? What were the mistakes that you think
What
you
were
made?
The mistakes that I made early on?
We got all day.
She's like,
I didn't make you say that.
I'm perfect.
No, I'm just thinking. I had a lot to learn on fundraising initially. So there were definitely errors that I made there, and I grew and approached that, and now I actually do fundraising training for candidates because I want them to know how to do that. There were sort of... There's a list of things, but they would be so local and technical to explain.
Why not?
I have a theory that's probably wrong, but I'll throw it out there anyway, which is that you had a wonkish background. And sometimes that's not the best.
No, that's actually great. Thank you for coming up with my error. You are correct. Throughout the primary and the general, I continued.
Hold on 1 second. Mark down the time where she said that. Okay, go on.
You're doing great, Sam.
Thank you.
You're doing great. I continued to be quite policy driven in how I talked to voters and audiences and things like that. And I just really believe that's important. But what I have come to understand in more reflection and thought is that for most voters, they care about the policy outcomes, but they recognize rationally that they don't have the time to spend analyzing policy. So what they're looking for often in a candidate is getting the feeling that they trust you and that you will fight for them, and that sometimes talking about policy detail is not the best way to convey that,
mm-hmm,
and that you do need to spend more time talking about yourself. And that's something that I wasn't comfortable with.
Yeah.
Was there an issue with, in terms of trust, the perception that you kind of parachuted in, that you weren't there a long time, you didn't, you know, your opponent had been a member of the school board, kind of put in the time?
Yes, that was a challenge. It was an inaccurate criticism, but it was a criticism.
How was it inaccurate?
Well, so I had been, Los Angeles had been my home since about 2007, and the race was in 2014, so that doesn't feel parachuted to me.
That guy was born and raised. He grew up in Santa Monica High School.
Swimming in the bay, hiking in the mountains.
That
was a line, yes. yes, absolutely.
Not the worst line.
Not the worst line. You know, I want to be clear. I have respect for my opponent. We're friends. That was certainly one of the angles he used in the campaign. I used other angles against him in the campaign.
Was that irritating just because, I mean...
Oh, of course. Do you ever have a candidate say that the attacks on them are not irritating?
No.
But how did you combat the parachuting problem?
Facts. I told my story. I told how long I'd been in the community, what I was involved in the community, and I demonstrated my commitment to the community by being there. And that was actually a challenge because running a grassroots fundraising operation takes more time,
yeah,
so it takes you out of the community, right? So this is part of the challenge with our entire fundraising system, is that the more time you're spending raising money, it's time you're not spending.
And you said 30 hours a week raising money?
Yeah, about 35 on the phone.
Just
and
on
then
the phone.
In addition to that, you have your fundraising events and also the types of endorsements or types of contributions you would get through endorsements by local organizations
sure.
and things like that.
So we're talking about a state senate race in which you probably spent 45 hours a week doing some form of fundraising.
Yes.
That's a job.
Yes.
One other thing that, I mean, the theme of this race, in my head at least, is that, you know, perhaps a lot of voters viewed you through the lens of the Rush Limbaugh incident.
Mm-hmm.
Did they? Did you feel that way?
Was yes. But
how did that manifest
especially
itself?
Especially in Palos Verdes. More conservative.
Oh, he's been waiting to drop that for a while. He studied up the district.
Yeah.
He did.
How did it manifest itself, though? I mean, in conversations, perhaps?
Well, so it's a pretty progressive district. So remember that when we say that there is a conservative part of the district, we are talking about a conservative part of Los Angeles, California. So everything's relative,
sure.
right? So I do remember a 4th of July parade where someone came up to me and said, "I won't pay for your birth control." And I said, "I don't want you to. Let's talk about the policy facts." And she didn't want to talk about the policy facts.
I'm shocked, yeah.
But most of the time, the way voters viewed me through that incident was complimentary and was a feeling that I think she will fight. I think she will stand up for us. I think she will be true to her principles, even if it's difficult.
But was it positive in a way that maybe you didn't want? Like, for instance, you're trying to establish yourself as a multi-issue candidate with roots in the community. And even though people are coming up and saying, "Thank you for standing up to Rush Limbaugh," that's not the perception you want voters to necessarily see.
Sure. Nobody wants to be viewed as one-dimensional, right? And so you want to talk about other issues too and things like that, but you have to meet voters where they are.
And I guess I have to ask, would voters sometimes overshare with you, like give you too much information?
Oh, yeah, but that's not unique to voters, right?
I mean, but maybe unique to you because you have this, you had the contraception
so
issue.
So anyone who works in one of these areas that that we are silent about as a society, if you have a very public experience or you work in those areas, people tell you. So when I worked for a domestic violence agency, people told me about domestic violence in their lives. Same thing for sexual assault, same thing for contraception, for abortion care. So yes, folks share very personal things with me. But you know what? I feel privileged that they're willing to do that, and I appreciate their confidence and trust in me because I actually think we need to, in safe ways, be more public about these things.
On the other side of that coin, although it was a very liberal area, I mean, what were the incidents of sexism that you faced during the campaign?
Yes. I think that electoral politics is perhaps one of the areas that is still the most sexist in our society. And I think it manifests in lots of ways, right? Like studies show that women give less money to political contributions. So if you're a female candidate dependent on female donors, that's a disadvantage. Female candidates often are given less money by donors, things like that. The biggest thing I felt was that there's a de facto assumption that male candidates are qualified, and we require female candidates to prove that they're qualified. There's not the same benefit of the doubt.
Is that subconscious or is that
Yes, I
conscious?
Think it's subconscious. Okay. I don't think that there are very many people who have conscious, intentional bias at this point, but there is unintentional bias that is quite rampant. And, you know, folks asked me if I had kids and if I was going to have kids and things like that, too. You get that.
Was there a singular moment on that topic that stands out for you?
Yes. I spoke at a community endorsement meeting where we both spoke, and I received an email afterwards that said, "You seem incredibly well-versed on the policy and really smart and capable, and it's too bad your opponent is such a nice guy."
Oh.
Wow.
That kind of lays it out, doesn't it?
It's sort of reminiscent of how the type of coverage Hillary gets on some of this stuff, where it's well, she, you know, seems a little mean or cackles or, you know.
Right. There's certain ways female candidates can and cannot present themselves, and male candidates have more fluidity and ability.
Did you have people in your campaign advising you on how to speak or how to sort of approach a certain form because of this issue? Did anyone say, hey, maybe you should, you know, wear a
smile more?
Smile more, yeah.
That seems to be
I actually was told to smile more, but I think they were right about that. I don't think that was actually a sexist critique in the situation. When men tell you to smile more on the street, that's sexist.
Yes.
In the situations that I was talking about, I actually did need to smile more. I'm a bit of an intense person and very serious. So.
You're told to be less angry.
I wasn't told to be less angry. I was told to emphasize connecting over policy technicality.
You mentioned earlier on that was hard telling the sort of more personal stories. Mm-hmm. Why was that difficult, and how did you figure that out? Did you think you ever figured it out by the end of the campaign, how to tell that story?
I think I actually figured it out after the campaign. So I think that I don't like it when candidates tell their personal stories, and because many of them do it badly, and I don't like the sob story, and I feel very false trying to make it sound like I faced adversity that I didn't, because that's often what the personal story is, right? Is like, this is what was so hard, and this is I came from dirt, and you know, and I am a straight white person. I just will not. So yes, there's been.
It can be tough.
Were you tempted to just sort of lie, like, you know, your dad worked as a barmaid, you know?
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, I actually was a bartender at one point, but no, you can't lie. You certainly can't
obviously
lie. Look, there are challenges that I and my family have faced, and I'm comfortable talking about those, and that's important. But I just, and I think, again, this is something women struggle with, is I just thought that I wanted to talk about why the minimum wage increase was important, and why we had to protect CEQA, and which is an environmental law in California. And
I'm ready to vote for you.
Thank you.
We're waiting for you. I mean, you're right. A lot of your work leading up to this was all policy, all sort of behind the scenes advocating for other people. Mm-hmm. And then this was a race where you actually had to advocate for yourself and sort of sell yourself in ways that maybe you weren't ever used to.
And that's challenging because especially in primaries or in Democrat-on-Democrat races, and in those are the only kinds of races we have in Los Angeles, in much of Los Angeles, it comes down to the person because you're not going to be able to find as many policy distinctions, especially when many candidates hide their policy distinctions during the campaign, right? All of that. So it does become very personal and about why you'll be better, and that's hard.
So why do you think you lost?
I think a number of reasons. I think that the top two system is stacked against the more progressive Democrat, and that's what we've seen in a number of races throughout California. I think probably the biggest reason is because there was a local billionaire who put in $1.6 million for my opponent.
Let's not
discount that. Yeah. He and I each raised about $1.4 million for our campaign, and then there was an extra $1.6 in independent expenditures for him. So that makes a difference.
That does.
Yeah.
Tell us about what election night was like.
Oh, it's awful. The general election night, I was just exhausted, like thoroughly exhausted, as I think probably most candidates are by the time they finally get to the finish line. And I had a sense in the days before, I felt that I was probably going to lose, because we'd seen this tumult of money. And I just kind of wanted to get through it and be done. Being at the party was hard. I hate election night parties. Like, why do we do that? Because it's great when you win, but it's not when you don't. So I was exhausted and upset, and mostly just feeling brokenhearted for our democracy. I was really upset about that money and how that money played and how broken the system is, and I was upset for the people who'd worked so hard for me. I felt like I hadn't delivered for them.
Did you feel, in a way, like you were a vessel for something bigger because of that fight with Limbaugh, and related to that, that your loss was a defeat that was larger than just a race?
Yeah. Yeah, I did. But mostly I felt it not around Limbaugh, but around campaign finance reform.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to see the grassroots campaign triumph over the independent expenditure operation. But that's not where we are right now.
So what were the emails like the day after? Or what was your day like the day after? Some people
slept.
Have great days.
I slept the whole day. So my close friend and the person who's running my campaign called my husband at like 5 o'clock the next day and was like, it's 5 o'clock and I haven't heard from her. I'm just checking in. And he's like, she's still asleep.
Wow. You slept the whole day.
5 p.m., not a.m.
Damn straight, I slept the whole day.
She'd been working 45 hours a week just on fundraising.
Yeah, I worked from 8 a.m. to midnight 7 days a week for a year. I was exhausted. So I just slept for quite a while for those first few days. And mostly I was just relieved. I wasn't like, oh my God, I lost. Me. I didn't feel that. I just felt tired and glad to be over the line. And but I did pretty quickly, it was like 36 hours or something, somebody told me, start talking about, so when I run next time, this is what we'll do.
Right. And there will be a next time.
There will be a next time if the time is right. I'm not someone who feels that I just need to be in office. I'm not someone who thinks that I'm God's gift to electoral politics or just need the ego or something. But I think that what I found and what I continue to see in my ongoing work, I'm the state director for a policy advocacy organization in California, is that this is a way that I can have the greatest impact. And so I will continue to fight to do that because that's what I want to do is have that impact. So when there's the right opportunity, I will be ready and ready to fight for it.
That was Sandra Fluck on her run for the state Senate in California in 2014. A big thanks, as always, to the editor of this podcast, Christine Canetta, who is just, you know, masterful is like probably the right word for this.
The way that she can handle your ego.
I know. And your inability to speak.
Well, you know, we all
That's
have
why
our,
she's the best.
We all have our faults.
Exactly. You can find Candidate Confessional on iTunes and on thehuffingtonpost.com. And tune in next week when we have a very special guest, the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who will talk about both his run in 1984 and in 1988 for the presidency.
It's a good one.
It's a really good one. Till then, dear listener, happy trails.